This week on COVID, Race, and Democracy.
It's time for the people of the world, those who are engaged in a struggle against colonialism, neo-colonialism, fighting against U.S. imperialism, to now point the finger back at the United States for their own human rights violations.
A panel of nine international legal scholars and human rights advocates found the U.S. guilty of five counts of genocide.
To take away the right of our brothers and sisters to strike is a violation of their human rights. Yeah, right. To take away their right to be sick so that they can speed up and exploit us more is a violation of our human rights.
The congressional bill that ordered the 120,000 railroad workers to continue working with no sick pay has brought growing anger in the labor movement.
Those who have chosen not to get the shots had tremendous trouble getting work.
Hollywood is starting to examine the effect of COVID measures, such as vaccine mandates, on workers in the industry.
At this point, it's a little hard to believe that Ukraine does anything without pre-clearance from the United States. We are literally attacking centers of nuclear power in Russia.
And the war in Ukraine is escalating with the recent drone strikes on two nuclear-equipped military bases deep inside Russia. Is the West provoking nuclear war? From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Last year, at an international tribunal in New York on U.S. human rights abuses against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples, a panel of nine international legal scholars and human rights advocates found the U.S. guilty of five counts of genocide. A detailed verdict was issued this summer. Pacifica producer Bob Lederer and his co-host Dr. Aisha Muhammad have more.
I'm Bob Lederer of Pacifica radio station WBAI and a member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition.
And I'm Dr. Aisha Mohammed of the National Jericho Movement, co-chair of Oakland Jericho, and a coordinating committee member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition.
Late last year, an unprecedented U.S. coalition called the Spirit of Mandela, including attorneys, academics, and organizers from the Black Liberation, human rights, Puerto Rican decolonization, immigrant rights, indigenous sovereignty, and earth protection movements, organized a two-day international tribunal in New York on U.S. human rights abuses against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. They presented evidence from 30 witnesses and many documents. A distinguished independent panel of nine international jurists, including legal scholars, human rights advocates, and community leaders, the majority of them from the Global South, issued a verdict, finding the U.S. guilty of five counts of genocide. Earlier this year, the panel of jurists issued a detailed 46-page verdict. The document built on historic precedents of previous findings of U.S. genocide by various international bodies.
The 2021 verdict relied on the 1948 United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, ratified by 152 nations. Besides forbidding mass murderers, the convention also outlawed, quote, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group and or deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. End quote. The verdict noted the widespread acceptance by scholars that a, quote, total, relentless, and pervasive genocide in the Americas, end quote, had occurred against indigenous peoples from 1492 to today, and U.S. treaties with native peoples had consistently been broken. As to the Black population, the jurist quoted the citations by Tribunal Chief Prosecutor Nkechi Taifa of, quote, racially biased executions and extrajudicial killings, whether by lynch mobs or officers of the law, end quote, as well as, quote, discriminatory treatment embedded in police departments, prosecutors' offices, and courtrooms, end quote. The jury's verdict found that the, quote, wrongs have been historic and deliberate, end quote, and that the various acts of genocide currently manifest as, quote, medical and digital apartheid, chemical warfare, environmental violence and racism, divestment, and a pandemic of accessible guns and drugs, with the majority of gun violence perpetuated by police and security forces, end quote. They also cited, quote, new forms of colonialism, such as the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, and the commercialization of our health and privatization, commodification of all social services, end quote.
The jurist's verdict called for authorities to go beyond simple apologies. Quote, the continued disparity of police killings and hypermass incarcerations, the continued incarceration of prisoners such as Leonard Peltier, Mumia Abu-Jamal, and Emim Jamil Al-Amin, the ongoing extreme health inequities causing the avoidable deaths of countless members of the affected groups, all indicate a need for urgent and immediate remediation, unquote. On a recent program on Pacifica Station WBAI, hosted by Betty Davis and Ralph Pointer, organizers of the tribunal and three of the jurists explained the significance of their verdict and the follow-up organizing efforts that are now underway. Matt Meyer is Secretary General of the International Peace Research Association, as well as a coordinating committee member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition and a special advisor to the jurists in the tribunal.
Spirit of Mandela Coalition is an ongoing U.S.-based effort for change that understands the U.S. genocidal politics against people of African descent, against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples. And one thing that changed in October of 2021 is that the charges were heard and accepted by a special international panel of nine jurists. And they declared in a preliminary verdict on October 21st and on a full final verdict on May 19th of this last year, 2022, the U.S. is unequivocally and clearly guilty of genocide.
Matt Meyer, Secretary General of the International Peace Research Association.
Magdalene Moonsami, a former member of South Africa's parliament and a longtime human rights activist, served as Chief Justice of the 2021 International Tribunal.
The tribunal that we had in October 2021 was indeed one of a kind in respect of the nature of those that were witnesses, which were 30 in total, but also in the nature of the counts that were charged in terms of the indictment and judged, which was that of police racism and violence, mass hyperincarceration, political prisoners and prisoners of war, environmental racism and public health inequities. And what we know about these indictments against the U.S. In respect of the overall genocide is the fact that the hyper-incarcerations, all of these charges are indeed race-based. And that we find not only in terms of race, but also in terms of indigenous peoples, there is an obvious discrimination. There is an obvious obfuscation of the democracy that the U.S. purports itself to have, and a deviation from the processes that must guide the future without having to carry the burden of feeling color and of feeling minority as being part of prejudice. And one of the observations that we made in terms of the United Nations Declarations of Human Rights and the rights of indigenous peoples was, is there Black genocide in the U.S.? And the issue of the Third Reich and whether it's continuum. And we know that there is a continuum of oppression, colonization, and genocide that is proving itself real globally. It needs to be considered because it seems as if the powers that be want to continue to exercise its arm and its threshold of power and threshold of oppression over the world over for a second and third and fourth time. There is not enough for them to want to be satisfied in so far as the role of those who are not seen to be historically perceived or classified as white.
Magdalene Munsami, former member of South Africa's Parliament and Chief Justice of the International Tribunal. Wilma Reverone, a Puerto Rican legal scholar with the Puerto Rico Bar Association, who has served as an expert for the United Nations Special Committee on Decolonization, which has repeatedly voted to declare the U.S. domination of Puerto Rico an illegal act of colonialism. Ms. Reverone was one of the jurists at the tribunal.
We know for a fact that the people of color who are being incarcerated are treated differently from the people of the white race. We know for a fact that torture is used in the prison system. And we had vivid testimony from brothers from the Black Panthers, brothers from the Puerto Rican Liberation Movement that were very explicit about the prison conditions that they endure, the discrimination that they had to suffer, the torture that they had to suffer in their persons, for example, under the international standards of prison system, more than 2 weeks in solitary confinement is considered a torture. And we have people like Oscar Lopez from Puerto Rico, who was under solitary confinement for over 12 years. And then the same thing repeats, for example, with what we call the environmental discrimination. In Puerto Rico, we have it very dramatized. For example, when there was this big fire of this petroleum refinery center in Puerto Rico, who were the neighbors there? Working class people, poor people, economically disadvantaged people. And we see the same story repeated, and we saw dramatic presentations, wonderful presentations on what was happening in places like Flint in Michigan and other places in Atlanta, where you could see graphically presented how these communities were targeted to put the most contaminating industries near their neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so this goes on and on, this discrimination in the prison system, discrimination in the environment, discrimination in the school system. It looks like we've been fighting this for at least what we know, the history that we know from 15th century to now. We've been fighting for this for 7 centuries.
Wilma Reverone with the Puerto Rico Bar Association.
Another tribunal jurist was Dr. Vicky Casanova Willis. She is past president of the National Conference of Black Lawyers and former executive director of the U.S. Human Rights Network.
There was no other decision to be made. The evidence was incontrovertible and irrefutable. I'm going to just read really quickly part of the language. There is widespread agreement that the settler colonialists committed genocide and other crimes against the indigenous populations while taking their lands, implementing a brutal relocation strategy, and attempting to erase their histories and cultures. I'm going to put a pin there and just say that continues. Right. This is not just a history story. Right. This is not just something to document what went on way back when. It's happening now and it must end, but it won't until courageous individuals step forward and convene tribunals and people's courts, if you will, to say, no, this is what the reality is. The second sentence in this one introduction only says no one would disagree that enslaved Africans were forced to work the stolen settler colonial lands for centuries in subhuman conditions, including torture, human trafficking, family separations, and forced breeding. We're talking about serial rapists. All of these crimes hold a very clear, I don't want to just say sentence. There is a recognition that there must be repair. That's really the bottom line. There has to be recognition. There has to be repair. That's where the reparation comes from. It's not just about paying a handful of people or their descendants for a small explanation of what we've been allowed to think about as civil rights. This really is about the sustainability and the existence of the planet and its people, all of our people. And those who have historically been placed at the bottom, quote unquote, continue to do the heavy lifting. We will continue to do that. And it was just an honor, as I said, to be a part of this work. There continues to be backlash, but we must continue to lift up the rights that have been promised, and that even if they hadn't been promised, everyone is entitled to them.
Dr. Vicki Casanova Willis, formerly with the U.S. Human Rights Network. Jihad Abu-Mumit served many years as a political prisoner for his Black Liberation Movement work. Jihad is chair of the National Jericho Movement and a coordinating committee member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition. He speaks to the significance of the jurist verdict and some of the next steps to follow up.
I just want the listening audience to really embrace for a moment the breadth and scope of what is happening here with this tribunal. We proved to our own people again, which in many respects are deluded into thinking that genocide is not happening, because that is the profound narrative of the United States government. But the problem is that it's become so normalized that we can see somebody get shot 60 times and say, oh my God, a couple of protests, and we have not designed or developed the mechanism to really combat this virulent historical and systemic police violence. Nor are we able to mount a serious effort to get our political prisoners out of prison or to diminish and abolish the prison industrial complex. We're definitely going to be impacted more adversely than anybody. We're talking about people of color with environmental racism and the pollution of the planet by corporate greed. And finally, we're always the victim of lack of medical care and health disparities. So this tribunal gives the opportunity, sisters and brothers, for us to be able to mobilize, utilizing the profound verdict and proving what has already been known to be true, and proving it in the minds and psyche of the people, to build a response network that will reach across the United States and network those wonderful organizations that's doing the work into a network that where we can communicate, share resources.
Jihad Abu-Mumit, Spirit of Mandela spokesperson.
Jalil Mutakim was a political prisoner from the Black Liberation Movement for 49 years until his release in 2020. After his release, he became a coordinating committee member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition. He outlines the significance of the jurist verdict and talks about the latest initiative to form a People's Senate.
I'm grateful, extremely grateful for the tribunal and what they succeeded in doing. We were able to achieve something that Paul Robeson, the W.D. Du Bois, and William Patterson sought to achieve in December 17th, 1951, about 2 months after I was born. And so for us, this was a huge historic success in having the international jurists listen to the testimony of 30 witnesses and boxes of materials and come up with a verdict, an actual verdict of guilt against the United States for their 500 years of practicing genocide on brown, black, and indigenous people. Now what is to be done? What is our next step? Naturally, we want to internationalize this verdict by the international juror. And the other reason why we want to do that, because we know that the United States engages in human rights violations around the world. And although they do so, they hypocritically purport themselves as being the great honor of human rights, when we know that they are this great disgrace of human rights. And so it is time for the people of the world, those who are engaged in struggles against colonialism, neo-colonialism, fighting against U.S. imperialism, to now point the finger back at the United States for their own human rights violations. Right? That the United States can no longer police the world hypocritically about other people's human rights violations without the people around the world who are engaged in these anti-imperialist movements to also point the finger at the United States for their human rights violations. Their practice of genocide that continues today. Even if we just consider the 13th Amendment of the United States Constitution that informs that slavery in America continues based upon law. The law says that the United States penal system is an actual slave system. And this is one of the issues that we raised by these raised on the International Tribunal on the issues of mass incarceration. Why are they incarcerating people in mass levels? Because there are some people, corporations, who are profiting off the labor of prisoners, which is both international, violation of international law, labor laws, but as well as a violation of the laws of genocide. And so for us, it is important for us to be able to talk about these matters both on a national and international level. Not only that, it is important for us, those people who have been dehumanized, colonized, or degraded by this system of genocide, to think of new means and methods for which we can govern ourselves. And so for us, those who are part of the Spirit of Mandela Initiative Committee have began to move towards building what we call a People's Senate. We think that it's necessary for us people, particularly people of color, in the United States, to consider how we have to figure out new ways in which we can govern ourselves as a system in which we have been governed by and genocidal. Right? So let's understand that point of departure from those who continue to seek to integrate and assimilate into a system of white supremacy and one that has also been engaged and been found guilty of genocide. I think it's time for us no longer to seek to integrate and assimilate, but actually to separate, to divorce ourselves from this corporate settler colonial government that has continued to be engaged in the process of genocide. So we are building towards what we call a People's Senate, and we ask people to go to spiritmandela.org and learn more about this People's Senate that we are building towards, trying to create people's assemblies across the country so they can consider how best to govern ourselves if this corporate government is engaged in the practices of genocide.
Jalil Muntakim, Spirit of Mandela spokesperson. For more information on the verdict from the International Tribunal on U.S. human rights abuses against Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples, and about the People's Senate currently being formed, go to spiritofmandela.org. That's spiritofmandela.org. I'm Dr. Aisha Mohammed with the National Jericho Movement, co-chair of Oakland Jericho, and a coordinating committee member of the Spirit of Mandela Coalition.
And I'm Bob Lederer with WBAI Radio and the Spirit of Mandela Coalition. And we want to thank Paulina Vasiliev for her meticulous editing and hard work on this segment.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
A classic by the great late Marvin Gaye, What's Going On? This is Pacifica's COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. The European Union has sanctioned 5 members of different armed groups operating in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo, including the spokesman for the M23 militia. It did not, however, sanction Rwanda, Uganda, or the Rwandan and Ugandan presidents, despite decades of UN groups of experts' reports that the militias operating in the eastern DRC are in fact Rwandan and Ugandan, even if they operate under Congolese names. Pacifica's Ann Garrison has the details.
Congolese journalist Nixon Katembo, who works for the South African Broadcasting Corporation, told an SABC host that both Rwandan Special Forces and the Rwandan proxy militia M23 are in eastern DRC.
the Rwandan Special Forces and the proxies of the M23 have gotten inside DRC, taken the military camp of Rumangabo, and take the city of Kiwanja. Some of us are in touch with the locals and some of the military units within Rwanda and inside the DRC who have confirmed to us that we are here.
Kitembo also pointed out that the discussions about ending the violence have not been between the government and M23, but between the Congolese government in Kinshasa and the Rwandan government in Kigali.
If you look at it, the discussions have been happening between government to government, between Kigali and Kinshasa. One need to ask a question, why government are engaging on behalf of the rebels? If Kigali says it's not supporting the M23, why is it discussing issues of the rebels on behalf of the rebels? Whether they defend their position, they would have said, well, this is what you're saying, bring the rebel to the tables. But instead, it's a meeting back and forth between President Kagame and President Tshisekedi.
Kitembo said that the Rwandan army has even infiltrated the Congolese army.
President Tshisekedi has spent 4 years in power, arguably leading an army that is divided, as I have said before, between three major parties, if you look at it. One that supports President Joseph Kabila, the former president. One that issue from different rebel groups that were formed after the constitutional framework of 2006. And the other one, that what they call the Zefiltre in terms of the DRC, those are people who have been patched inside the DRC government's army, but mostly, most of them, working on behalf of Kigali.
That was Congolese journalist Nixon Kitembo on the long-running catastrophic conflict in the Eastern Democratic Republic of the Congo. For Pacifica, I'm Ann Garrison.
The U.S. and NATO proxy war on Russia is escalating, with the recent Ukrainian drone strikes on two nuclear-equipped military bases deep inside Russia, Pacifica's Paulina Vasilyev reports.
According to the Russian Defense Ministry, two strategic bomber bases in the Ryazan and Saratov regions of Russia came under attack by drones on the morning of December 5th. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has denied the U.S. had anything to do with Ukrainian drone strikes on the two airfields deep inside Russia, but vowed to continue supplying Kyiv with anything it needs. Colonel Richard Black, former head of the Criminal Law Division at the Pentagon, says that the West is provoking nuclear war.
The West, NATO, the United States, the U.K., understand that Ukraine has lost the war. They will not win the war. There's absolutely no chance of them winning. And what has happened is that the West has become incredibly, almost insanely reckless in provoking a nuclear war. We've done it in the past. We sabotaged the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines. They don't belong to us. They belong to Germany and to Russia. But we sabotaged them to cut off the gas. We helped to sink the flagship of the Russian fleet, the cruiser Moskva. We sent to the bottom 300 young Russian sailors. The recklessness is so extreme. Now we're flying drones, and I say we, the United States has disavowed any involvement But at this point, it's a little hard to believe that Ukraine does anything without pre-clearance from the United States. We are literally attacking centers of nuclear power in Russia. And I'm sure that there are at least some elements that do it with the intention of triggering a spark, setting off a spark that will ignite the nuclear holocaust and probably kill 60% of the world's population and most all of the people in the West.
That was Colonel Richard Black, former head of the Criminal Law Division at the Pentagon, speaking to George Galloway. For COVID, Race and Democracy, I'm Polina Vasilyev.
The congressional bill that ordered 120,000 railroad workers to continue working with no sick pay has brought growing anger in the labor movement. On December 13th, the Teamsters and the Smart Union called for protests around the country. A labor solidarity rally for the railroad workers was also held in New York on December 7th with 150 trade unions from around the city. Teamsters 808 Secretary Treasurer Chris Silvera talked about their rally and what labor must do to fight back. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zelter.
Sick days are human rights! Sick days are human rights!
Steve Zelter with Pacifica, and I'm with Chris Silvera, who's Secretary Treasurer of IBT Local 808, and he had helped organize a rally in New York to support the railway workers. And this rally was the first union rally, actually, union-sponsored rally, held in the United States to support the railroad workers and their right to strike. So welcome to our show. So, Chris, why don't you talk about why you and others organized a rally and why it's important that other workers around the country join together to support these railroad workers.
And we just had a conversation. We all agreed, take the time. In front of Grand Central Station yesterday at 5 o'clock, and we had about 150, maybe 200 people that turned up.
What was the sentiment of workers at that rally?
The sentiment of the workers was an understanding that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party had failed the working class. And there was certainly an extreme disappointment in the Democratic Party, as they tend to like to present themselves as being worker-friendly.
In 2020! 2020, they began to call us essential workers. And we are.
Yes.
But we are essential whether we're on the job or whether we're home sick. Yes. And so if we're essential, we demand sick time. We demand sick pay. Yes. And so that's what this here solidarity is about.
To take away the right of our brothers and sisters to strike is a violation of their human rights. To take away their right to be sick so that they can speed up and exploit us more is a violation of our human rights. So we came tonight to make a statement. We saw our airline pilots were here.
And I believe you could take away from it that the spirit for a national general strike was in the air. You know, you see the New York Times, they're going on strike. When you see 20, 25 pilots in uniform from Southwest Airlines come and participate, it tells you that the working class understands they're getting beat up by both parties and something needs to be done.
Good evening, everyone. We did not know we were going to be speaking tonight, so we'll keep this short. I am Brian, and I am with my fellow brothers and sisters from SWAPA, Southwest Airlines Pilots Association. We're here to stand with you in a show of support so that you understand that as another work group, another labor group, under the Railway Labor Act, we see what's happening. We support you. We want you to get what you need to get and get where you need to be. And know that you are not alone. We are watching and we support you.
Our brothers and sisters, to strike is a violation of their human rights. To take away their right to be sick so that they can speed up
and exploit us more is a violation of our human rights. So we came tonight to make a statement. We saw our airline pilots were here in solidarity to make a statement. And so the program tonight is one of solidarity with our brothers and sisters who fight every day to transport and deliver you and goods and services across this country, who have been dealt a terrible injustice.
The ground is fertile now to make something happen that will bring long-term gain for the working class.
And the idea that the U.S. government, the Democrats and Republicans, would vote to send the railroad workers to back to work with a agreement with no sick leave and using the Railroad Labor Act as the rule, it seems like they want slave labor.
Yes, but the first, so, you know, in all defense, the first letdown of the workers came from their own unions, who, having this power, go to meetings with Joe Biden and allow Joe Biden and Secretary of Labor and the Secretary of Transportation to beat them down to protect the party for their midterm election and elicit nothing in return. And so that's the first letdown, because they had the power to say to Joe Biden, say, listen, I understand you got a midterm and I understand you're about to get blown out of the water, but if we don't have these sick days, so be it. What do I care, right? So they let their workers down. That's the first letdown, right? So, and this is why rank and file have to become involved and start to demand things, and not just demand from their leadership, but change the leadership if the leadership continues to come back with inferior collective bargaining agreements. Then they're let down by the Democrats / Republicans. They knew it was going to fail. Once they split the bill in two, one go back to work, one 7 sick days, I knew then it was going to fail. It was intended to fail because both parties served the boss. There comes a point when the entire system has told you there is no place for you. There's not enough money in the economy to send money to Ukraine, none for you, to send money to Afghanistan and Iraq and billions and trillions and none for the working class, right? Where there's a refusal to tax these wealthy corporations, tax these venture capitalists that now own these railroads. There's a point where you have to resist unjust laws, unjust bills, whether it's coming from Congress, the mayor, or whomever. And this is the time for us to do something that John Lewis liked to talk about called getting into some good trouble. There is no question that, again, that the time is ripe to build. I mean, nobody's going to just jump off a ship into the ocean, but we have to start rapidly building a workers' party owned and controlled by the unions, independent of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. The cost to give them the 7 sick days is $320 million or so, out of a loss of a one-day strike of $2 billion. It seems to me that it makes sense to make a settlement, because the settlement would really end up being about 2% of total profits, and the railroads are running at 50% profit year over year. It is criminal. It is inhumane. Let me tell you something. These guys are working in snowstorms. They got to clean the switches in the hottest of summer. In the rain, pick weather, the number one killer of railroad workers is silica dust. Dust from the gravel that they use to hold the tracks together. And this is the number one killer, because as they dump stone and regulating the tracks and what have you, tamping, dust is being stirred up all the time, being inhaled, and it never leaves your lungs. Okay? And in these conditions, and in a post-pandemic, so think of people getting COVID and having no sick days. And so you're out for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, depending on how hard COVID hit you, and you didn't get one sick day? Not one day's pay? Not one day's pay?
And while the U.S. government is spending another $35 billion for the war in Ukraine, that's what the Biden administration and Blinken are pushing for, they're saying that people that have COVID or cannot get tests, that people being charged, poor people can't afford to get tests in the midst of a pandemic.
Dramatic demand for profit. There is not enough money to spread around. So we don't have enough money for the military-industrial complex versus healthcare. We don't have enough money for the military-industrial complex versus clean drinking water in Flint or Jackson, Mississippi, and so many other communities that suffer from old. I mean, just think of how old the pipes in New York are. You know, Boston, Chicago, some of the oldest cities in this country. I mean, just think of the amount of work that could be generated.
That was Teamsters 808 Secretary Treasurer Chris Silvera talking with Pacifica Steve Zelter.
Under the pressure, if your fortune be taken away, no, we cheat in a second, cause we all under pressure, my friend. Sometimes when you feel it, you cry down. I hurt your heart, you know, but do not make it stress, cause it I feel be better, not feel living at the ghetto, feel be under the pressure, my friend.
I'm we born in the struggle, isolated in a bubble. One now for the rich, yet another for the poor. God bless and please help us, we can't take no more. We're feeling the pressure, we are down to the core. Oh, money for the young, when them send it offshore. And every nation come here, get rich and we stay poor. Them show you $20, we'll go through the back door. Tell them, so we can't take no more.
Under the pressure. Coffee featuring Bougie Bonton. Pressure. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Hollywood is starting to examine the effects of COVID measures such as vaccine mandates on workers in the industry. KPFK's Ziri Riddell reports.
Hollywood has been heavily impacted by COVID and the ensuing heavy safety measures and restrictions. Increasingly, actors and production staff have started speaking out against the ongoing COVID restrictions and the divisions that have been created as a result of the policies. Tim Robbins famously apologized to the unvaccinated for the way they were treated in an interview with Matt Taibbi, where he also stated, quote, "I understand the fear. I was there, and I demonized people. But I heard people saying, if you didn't take the vaccine and you got sick, you don't have a right to a hospital bed. It made me think about returning to a society where we care about each other. I think we lost a lot of ourselves during this time. You shouldn't be excluded from society for not getting a shot. I think that was a mistake." End quote. In November, actor Ice Cube lost a $9 million movie because he refused to get vaccinated.
I turned down a movie because I didn't want to get the jab, you know. I turned down $9 million because I didn't want to get the jab.
Didn't want to get, you know,
that jab, and y'all for trying to make me get it.
I didn't turn it down.
Didn't give it to me because I wouldn't get the shot.
How were the production crews dealing with a heavy legacy of the COVID restrictions? We spoke to Kristen Glover, who is on the board of the Cinematographers Union.
I sit on the National Executive Board of IATSC Local 600, which is the Cinematographers and Publicists Guild. That is one way I stay connected to my colleagues still working in the business.
Mm-hmm.
I will just say that my own experience in the very beginning was that we were all very frightened. My husband and I would, you know, wipe down our groceries with Purell, you know, until after a few months we looked at each other and we went, why are we doing this? Everything changed when the shots were rolled out. Everything changed. Before that, Hollywood had a return to work agreement prior to the shots where people were basically just wearing masks and gloves and trying to stay away from each other. But when the shots were rolled out, that changed the game completely for a lot of people. It changed the game for me because I decided not to get the shot, and so I was demonized and villainized by friends and colleagues. And I've been talking to a lot of colleagues who are still working in the business, and their experience has been the same. Those who have chosen not to get the shots had tremendous trouble getting work. This has been one of the worst problems, and Fran Drescher references it in her statement from a few months ago.
SAG-AFTRA President Fran Drescher has been outspoken about her support for the unvaccinated and her concerns about Hollywood's COVID-19 vaccine mandates. Her union represents about 160,000 workers.
I have been outspoken publicly as well as with my board and executive director in defense of those members who are unvaccinated for a myriad of reasons, and as a consequence has lost their livelihoods, their representation, and their health benefits. The reason that there are so many prescriptive drugs at the pharmacy is because there isn't one kind that works for everyone. So to think that every human on the planet can take one vaccine is ludicrous. And to make that one vaccine the criteria for who is allowed to work, travel, dine, go to theater, etc., is an infringement on the Disabilities Act, the Freedom of Religion Act, and body sovereignty. We as a nation must be very careful that fear does not turn into fascism. When equal citizens stop being equal, when cards must be presented to identify whether you are included or excluded, we stand at a tipping point of an America I no longer recognize. And even though I myself am vaccinated, I must applaud Disney for taking the position not to vaccine mandate their sets any longer. The problem with discrimination is that there will always be good people who justify it because of an extreme condition. But it is those times especially when we must fight even harder to protect the sanctity of freedom for all and never succumb to an us versus them mentality.
Fran Drescher's statement led to heated debates within the union. Kristen Glover knows many people who have lost their livelihoods just because they refused to get the shot.
I talked to a friend of mine whose income went from $120,000 in 2020 to $20,000 in 2021. I've talked to several colleagues and even some actors I've spoken to who've lost their health care, they've lost their careers, they're really struggling to make it and to survive. I've also heard from colleagues that more and more people are beginning to wake up and they're saying, I don't want any more shots. I don't want to have to take any more shots to work on set. So something is beginning to change that way.
So. And so how was the atmosphere when you say you were demonized? Who talked to you, like these people from the union, your peers?
It was societal. But in Hollywood, as I referenced, there was a return to work agreement, which has been renegotiated several times. When the shots came out, it was renegotiated to basically say you have to get the shots in order to work. But now the return to work agreement, which is between Screen Actors Guilds, SAG-AFTRA, IATSE, Teamsters, DGA, and the producers. And it's all their top leaders who negotiate that. The members don't really get any input on that. They're just told this is what you have to do. And now I am hearing that it's up to each producer, each production company or each producer on each production makes the decision of whether you have to mask, whether you have to have shots, whether you have to be tested. So now it's very relaxed, but it's also very inconsistent, which is interesting to me. You know, it's like either you have a health issue and it needs to be addressed uniformly or shouldn't be addressed.
What can Hollywood do to heal the divides the COVID policies have created?
One of the things that maybe will help bring the conversation forward is that it's common knowledge now, it's pretty much common knowledge, even though a lot of people don't want to admit it, that the shots don't work. They don't prevent transmission, and they don't prevent you getting sick, which is what they were promised to do back in early 2021. It was promised that they would work 100%. They would keep you from getting sick. You wouldn't transmit the disease. And now they've changed the narrative to, oh, well, it'll keep you from dying, it'll keep you from going to the hospital. People have to know that the narrative has changed and that the shots are apparently ineffective and possibly very dangerous. So this is a huge, huge story. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are many more people who probably are very unhappy that they were forced to take the shots. And there are many people, more people probably, who have lost their careers, lost their health care, lost friends and family, not to COVID, but to the division and to the argument.
That was Kristen Glover, member of the National Executive Board of Cinematographers Guild, speaking to Ziri Rideau of KPFK Pacifica Los Angeles. Classic by the Soulistics, People Make the World Go Round. Congresswoman Elisa Slotkin blasted Republicans in late September for their heartless, violent approach to women's health during a debate over an abortion measure in a veterans bill. The Congresswoman reacted viscerally to GOP pushback to the Solid Start Act, which would help veterans transition to civilian life.
If you want to take a veterans bill and make it about abortion, then let's do it. What you are saying, and you're saying in front of the American people, is that you believe a veteran who has been raped, who is the victim of incest, and who is having a dangerous miscarriage, does not deserve access to abortion. You are saying, unless you correct me and tell me what you believe a woman deserves to have when she has been raped, the victim of incest, or is in the middle of a dangerous miscarriage, if you can't state it, then be clear. You believe in no exceptions for women. A cold, heartless, violent approach to women's health. You want to ban all abortions. That is your goal. Many of you have been open about that. And if you flip the House, we know that you will put forward a full ban on all abortion for all states. You've been clear about it. You want to turn a veterans bill into an abortion bill? Let's do it. Not one of you are a medical doctor. Not one of you. What the VA guidelines say is that if you've been raped or the victim of incest or a medical professional deems that your pregnancy is a risk to your health, the one of four women in this country who has had a miscarriage, probably many women in this room, that you are a better judge of who gets to decide the future of their life and not a medical doctor? Who do you think you are? You are politicians. We are all.
That was Democratic Congresswoman from Michigan, Elisa Slotkin. Republicans objected to the requirement that the Department of Veteran Affairs provide female veterans with information tailored to their specific health care needs, which would adhere to a new VA policy providing abortion access for women vets who are victims of rape, incest, or whose life is jeopardized. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's show was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akua Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zelter. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.